And now, on the African American Athlete Sports Network, it's Express Yourself with hosts T. Ramon and Sko.
Express Yourself!
It's an hour packed with guests, opinions, sports news of the day, and off-the-field issues that impact play on it. And you, the listeners, will have an opportunity to express yourself on our call-in line as well. Now here's our Express Yourself hosts, veteran sports journalists Tim Turner and Roscoe Nance.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Express Yourself with T. Ramon and Sko. I'm Tim Turner, along with co-host Roscoe Nance. We are really looking forward to tonight's show. We have just one of the legends of football, college football, and an incredible NFL player and a great coach, a great administrator at the NFL level. We have with us tonight Doug Williams, and we'll be excited to get with Doug. But here in Atlanta, all the buzz is Super Bowl 53. I was out at the airport when the Patriots and the Rams came in to throngs of adoring fans, and the town is just on fire here with everybody excited about being the host city for this latest edition of the Super Bowl. So we want to chop it up a little bit. We'll talk a little bit about some NBA news, a little bit about tennis with Naomi Osaka winning the Australian Open, some baseball news, basketball news, just a lot of things going on here tonight. So, Roscoe, how are you feeling tonight, sir?
I'm doing great, Tim. Looking forward to the Super Bowl and all the hubbub surrounding that and the awards that are going to be handed out over the weekend. And great show tonight with Doug.
Well, that's great. I know there's the Hall of Fame, the next class of Hall of Fame, those guys find out on Saturday evening. You have the award ceremony on Saturday evening. But in the meantime, there's so much going on. They got the NFL experience down around the Mercedes-Benz Stadium. This town is really cleaned up, spruced up. The graffiti is the nicest graffiti you'll see anywhere in America this over the past couple of weeks. They've done a really great job of turning everything into like a civil rights icon theme throughout the town. Very clean. People are very Atlanta's getting a great reputation as being a very hospitable town. And I understand that one Boston sports writer, Dan Shaughnessy, made mention that the hospitality here in Atlanta is a lot better than all of the sports teams' records. So, you know, that's a little bit of a shot, but we'll take it. So people are looking forward to seeing the Patriots out and the Rams out. Today was the first day of practice. The Pats were over at Georgia Tech, while the Rams are like 40 miles away up in Flowery Branch. And it seems they've given the Patriots some sort of deference to me, because their hotel is the Hilton, which is downtown, and Georgia Tech is maybe 5-6 miles from the hotel, whereas the Rams hotel is in Buckhead, and they have to drive 40 miles up the road to Flowery Branch and back. So, you know, the travel, a little wear and tear on the bodies. Maybe it'll have effect. Maybe it won't.
Oh, come on, man. Come on.
It's a conspiracy.
Come on. Come on. You know, it ain't even game day, and give it a rest. Let them play, and the best team will win.
We'll let it slide. I'm quite sure players on both sides don't even care, but I know there's somebody who does care, and probably has fond memories of his outstanding Super Bowl game against the Denver Broncos. And he's with us on the line right now. Is Doug Williams, Grambling great. Doug, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing good. You know, I was listening to you talk about how close the Patriots are and compared to the Rams. You know, they both in the Super Bowl. I don't think mileage makes a difference.
There you go.
They'll walk 40 miles, okay?
Yeah.
Crawl 40 miles. Right. Crawl 40 miles to be in the Super Bowl.
I can remember, actually, the day is, tomorrow will be the 31st. It'll be 31 years ago, before the game, we lived some 50 minutes away from the stadium the night before the game. So, you know, it's not about the distance, because most teams don't be within striking distance of the stadium. It's the mindset and what you do on the field.
Right. Well, Doug, talk about, you know, that time leading up to the Super Bowl, that week leading up to the Super Bowl, and all of the ancillary activities and things, and how teams handle that.
Well, you know, for me personally, it was a little different, but from a team standpoint, you know, I think I was blessed and I was fortunate enough to be on a team that had already been to the Super Bowl a couple of times. Most of the guys, them veterans. So, you know, I had a guy that lived up here at the time and became AD at Grambling, bless his soul, got by the name of Peter Piper. And one thing he told me before I went to the Super Bowl, he told me that if you don't belong, act like you do. I took that to heart, because what he was telling you, remember, the Super Bowl is a game. For us, for players, it is a game. For corporate America and the media, it's their party. But the players got to keep it within perspective, because it's still within the lines of the field. Everything happened in between the lines. And that's all your mind should be on. All the other stuff, the hype, parties and all that, it has nothing to do with playing. And you got to make sure mentally you do that. I think a lot of young teams who've never been to the Super Bowl, you know, take it out of proportion. You know, you got a team like the Patriots who've been there many, many times, and they understand what they're up against. And you know, I can bet you they can have as much fun yesterday, today, and tomorrow, but the closer they get, the more they're going to shut it down and realize it's all about business.
You know, I was going to ask you, because of the Patriots' experience, does that give them an advantage over the Rams? Or?
It gives you an opportunity to understand what the game is all about. But I think, you know, when you're talking about football, the Rams has a real good football team. You can't take that for granted that the Patriots are going to beat the Rams just because they got experience. Because, you know, when the ball is kicked off, a lot of different things happen. And teams make different things happen. The Rams certainly have the type of player that can dictate to a game, just like the Patriots. So I think it's more down to what team makes the less mistake and what team can play better defense.
Right. Now you getting up there with your Super Bowl week had a bit of a little bit of a hiccup. And this is Tim Turner, and Roscoe Nance is with us here as a co-host, and both of us worked at the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi. And
right.
I think
you worked with Jones at that time.
Exactly. We both worked with Butch, and then the big crazy controversy that went on. So why don't you just talk about it? Can you clear that up once and for all about how long you've been a black quarterback?
Well, you know, you said it's been a big hiccup. I think we all got to be fair to America, I guess. But, you know, America was not used to a black quarterback playing the Super Bowl. That's the first time that ever happened. And I guess the excitement was there. It was up to me to make sure that I didn't get as excited as the media got about asking it. Of course, I wondered what it was going to be like as to me as a player. And Bruce Jones, bless his soul, you know, him and I talked about that. And actually, he apologized, and what he told me that he respected the fact the way I handled the question, because I understood where he was coming from. And I think with all the people around, he just wanted to get his question out, and didn't come out the way that he would have liked for it to have come out. And all of a sudden, he just said, "How long you been a black quarterback?" And in my mind, I'm thinking what he really wanted to ask me, how long has the emphasis on me being a black quarterback was there. And what I answered was the fact that, you know, when I was at Grambling, I was Grambling's quarterback. And, you know, when I came to the NFL, I became a black quarterback. And that's the honest God truth, because when I was in Tampa, nobody ever wrote about Doug Williams, the quarterback of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. It was either Tampa Bay black quarterback Doug Williams or Doug Williams, the black quarterback of Tampa. whichever way they wanted to put it. It was so much emphasis to put on it at that time. And I think that's what happened to Butch. He got caught up in that. And, you know, and I understood where he was coming from.
Okay.
So
yeah.
how did you handle all of that, you know, when you got to Tampa and all of a sudden now, rather than just being a quarterback, you are a black quarterback? I mean,
Russell, to be honest with you, it was easy for me to handle because every morning that I got up, I understood I was black. So by them putting the emphasis on it, didn't bother me at all. It bothered them more than it bothered me. Because I understood who I was and what I was and what I was dealing with. The most important thing for me is to not to let that weigh on what I was trying to accomplish, what I was doing. You know, I didn't let the blackness of my skin weigh on, bring me down because of what I was doing. I just took it in stride and realized that, hey, this is what the good Lord gave me, and this is what I have to work with.
Well, talk about Eddie Robb, Coach Robb's role in preparing you for that stage.
Well, you know, bring a body down, Rascal, and then you know Coach a little bit. You know, whether it was me on that stage, any player that no matter what position you play for Eddie Robinson, it's not about the stage as much as about the world that you're about to enter. And Coach always talks about what it's like out there in that world, what you got to be able to do. And that's, you know, that's why he was so big on getting a degree. That's why he's big on going to church. That's why he's big on treating people the way you want to treat and being a good American, because that's what you had to go up against. And for me, you know, I took all that to heart. And I think when I left Grambling, I really, really understood the impact of being around Eddie Robinson for 5 years and just listening to him and realizing that it wasn't just about the X's and O's. It was about the people that you had to work with every day and the people you had to deal with every day and to be the good individual that you can be, because that's what life is all about. Life is about people. And in regard, you know, when people say, I don't want to be bothered, you know what? Too bad, because if whatever you do in life, whatever kind of job you have, I don't know a job that people are not involved. And you got to be able to deal with individuals.
Well, obviously, Coach Robb laid the foundation for you, because you didn't have any qualm about going up. You know, you coached at Grambling not once but twice. You had two stints there. And what was that like to be at your alma mater twice?
You know, when I went to Grambling, number one, my oldest brother was my mentor. The way when I look back on it, and I wanted to be like him. I wanted to be a coach. And if I had not played in the National Football League, I probably would have had a long high school or whatever coaching career. That's what I wanted to do. And to go to Grambling and be around Coach Robinson, you learn so much about how to deal with individual guys and talk to them and what you're dealing with and what you want out of them and how important it is for them to stay focused on what they're doing, their task and everything. And when I went back to Grambling, as a coach, you know, what you got to understand, when I left Grambling, Coach had already had 30-something years up on his belt. I had been in my wildest dreams to have my opportunity to go back to Grambling and replace Eddie Robinson 20-something years later. So, I mean, that in itself, I think, is unbelievable. Man, that 57 years there and that 37 when I left. You know?
Wow.
And I know would have thought my youngest brother, Mike, who played after me, and my roommate, Ricky Grant, they all tried to talk me out of going back to Grambling at that particular time. And because they told me that, man, you can't replace Eddie Robinson. And what I told them, they were right. You don't replace Eddie Robinson. What you do, you bronze his shoes and you put his shoes up on a pedestal. And you put your own shoes on there. You can't replace him. That'll never happen. You know, and I understood that. And unfortunate that, you know, the last two seasons of coaching, you know, he was 3-3, 3-8 back to back. And I figured if I was going to ever get an opportunity to go in there, and I had that chance to go then, because there was nowhere to go but up. And that was because the program was down, and we were fortunate enough to do that for 6 years. And, you know, in a six-year period of time, we won 3 straight swag championships. And, you know, that was pretty good, and I enjoyed it. Got a chance to deal with a lot of young guys. Today, when I go back and see these guys, you know, and they say, hey, coach, you know, they got their families with them and kids and all things. And that's what it's all about, knowing that you have some young guy along the way.
So let's go back to your Super Bowl experience. And you had some obstacles to overcome, you know, the root canal. The night before the game, then you hyperextended your knee early in the game. What enabled you to fight through that and have the kind of record-setting performance that you did?
Well, we're Rascal number one. It was the Super Bowl. Let's put it in perspective. You know, you know, you don't wake up in the morning and get there. You know, it's not the easy task. And I say that, I'm thinking about heartbroken for New Orleans at the same time when I think about you don't just get there. I mean, no matter how close you are, you don't just get there. And the root canal that Saturday, you know, I didn't practice at all that Saturday. A lot of people don't even know that I had a root canal that day of Saturday, 4 hours, and just went to the hotel and just, you know, went to my room in pain, trying to get the soreness out of my mouth and all this, and woke up the next morning, felt real good. Felt real good. And, you know, on that ride into Jack Mercer Stadium, you know, I was just actually playing my whole life, really, backwards as to how I get here. You know, from where I was at that particular time all the way back through the USFL and Tampa and Grambling and Cheneyville High School and growing up in Zachary. You know, you just put it in reverse. You know, that 50-minute ride to the stadium gave me an opportunity to do that. And, you know, when you get in the dressing room and you walk in your locker and you see your uniform and you realize that there's only 2 teams playing today, and you and the other team, and this is for the championship for the National Football League. That's one heck of a feeling. And, you know, you put your uniform, go get tape, put your uniform on, set your locker for a minute, and before you know it, the time is running out. You got to come out that dressing room sometime. And you walk out there and you look at the stadium, you realize that, you know, this is all over the country. Everybody in America and a lot of other country got eyes on that game. And, you know, went out there in the first quarter. You know, wasn't that going right? Nothing at all was going right. You know, and Denver was up 10 to nothing. Before a blink of an eye, and we knew what we were dealing with because you got John Elway on the other side. You got a good defense, you know, and we were drafting football. We weren't able to run the football. I slipped and hyperextended my knee. Didn't really know at the time I went down whether or not I was going to be able to come back. And I laid there for a minute, and the trainer comes out and intended to put his hand on my knee, and I told him, at that particular time, I told him, don't touch me. I say, don't touch me because if the good Lord let me get up off this turf, that I was going to finish the game. And you know what? I was blessed. The good Lord let me do it. And, you know, the rest is history.
Yeah.
Well, Doug, speaking of that game, and you had to know, you had to have felt, you know, you don't put any additional pressure on yourself, but you had to have felt that once it was Doug Williams going against the Denver Broncos all of a sudden became Al-Qaeda for black people. Because the idea that the entirety of black America was probably rooting for the Redskins for that one game and wanting you to win as much. Did you even think about any of that? Did that ever even wash over you even after the game that so many people were pulling for you?
Well, I think there's a lot of people pulling for them, but not all black folks. Over the years, I ran across some black folks who saying they were Denver fans, they were pulling for Denver. So not all black folks were pulling, but that's fine too. But you know, the way I viewed that was this. I was smart enough to know what I was up against and what was going on and what it meant to the game of football, what it meant to America, what it meant to a lot of blacks and a lot of whites. you know, for that matter. But most of the black folks who understood what had happened, especially older black guys who had to go through a lot growing up, I'm sure that game was very, very instrumental in their life. And I know that because I run across a lot of older black guys now, and they'll tell you now that they still had a tape. But it was what I had to do was not to let that overtake me. I couldn't use that as a crutch. I had to understand that I was the quarterback of the Washington Redskins who just happened to be black. And that's how you had to look at it. You know, I didn't go there as a black quarterback. I went there as the quarterback of the Washington Redskins. And the most important thing was to make sure you knew the game plan, make sure you watched tape on Denver, make sure you understood the blitz package, make sure you understood your plays and the signals coming in. That was the most important thing to me. And I said this, after the game was over with, you know, I have no problem. You color me any color you want. Because I knew I was black going in. I knew I was going to be black when it was over with. But I couldn't let the fact that there were so many black people riding on my shoulders, I couldn't carry that weight. And what I did was kind of set it on the side. And I didn't mind picking it up when it was out or when it was over with.
Right. Now, you mentioned your root canal and your pain that you had, and you mentioned the Saints sort of in passing there. Now, the obvious pass interference in the Saints-Rams game, what's your take on that? Do you feel a special pain for the players on the Saints, because some of those cats probably will never get another shot at playing in this game? What's your thoughts on that?
I got some pain closer than that because my son worked for the Saints.
Oh. Yeah. Wow.
My son DJ is dying there. Yeah, I feel his pain. You know, I had to talk to him, you know. So you can imagine what that's like. But, you know, you got to look at this thing in realistically. You know, the Saints, 2 years in a row, something drastic had happened for them. They stopped them from going forward. And, you know, that don't usually happen to a football team. But at the same time, if that call had happened mid-season, we wouldn't be here talking about it. It just so happened it was one of those crucial times. And I feel for the organization. I feel for a lot of the players because you got to understand, it ain't that easy to get there. And we don't know what's going to happen in the future. But I can say this, that they got to live with that the rest of their life, and that ain't an easy pain to live with.
Well, have you ever experienced anything anywhere close to that? You know, maybe not a playoff game,
well,
but any game where caller like that.
I don't remember offhand, but I'm sure we all had some games where some blatant things happened and wasn't called. But you know, you just got to run it up, you know, just go it on. I remember I can go all the way back to college and we played John Merritt at Tennessee State. And Rascal, you probably would understand this a little better than a lot of folks. And I can remember throwing the interception and the defensive back fell to his knees and got up and ran it back. There wasn't nobody running behind him and they ruled the touchdown. So you know
that was at the hole.
This is in Nashville.
That was in Nashville at the hole.
Yeah,
and down the hole. And think about it. That was in 1975. Think about it. All the players wanted to walk off the field, wanted to quit. And Coach Ross said, "Hell, you can't quit. Hell, you just got to outscore them." And believe it or not, we ended up winning the football game.
Now you're a talent evaluator now in your role as a senior VP of player personnel with the Redskins, and the question I want to have you is about the quality of HBCU football players that you see now, as opposed to when you were playing, and then going forward. Do you see, are they getting the same quality players? Because it doesn't seem like they're getting the same. Well, the draft is kind of indicative of that.
I don't think, you know, we can even equate to what it used to be, you know. Think about this, man. The Walter Payton draft not only produced Walter, but also Ralph Bazile and later the Ricky Patton, the Ricky Young, and Jackie Slater. You know, it's unfair to even to ask the question, and he pointed to that. The same year, Grambling, you know, had Big Hand Johnson and Robert Barber, he's up till Jesse O'Neill, then come Sammy White, James Hunter. That doesn't happen anymore in black college because the guys, the kids have so many options now. I think we're fortunate enough to get the guys like Darius Leonard and Tariq Coyne and the Smith kid down in Tampa and the nose tackle over in Pittsburgh. You know, every now and then you're going to get you two or three guys from black college that's going to show up. But I think, too, we in the black college, we got to do a better job. I think the coaches got to make them understand that, you know, you didn't come here to go to the pro, but you got an opportunity if you do what is right, if you got the talent. See, that's the problem that it have. All the talent's not there, but it's, you know, you don't go to college just to be in the professional ranks because everybody's not going to get that. But everybody's not going to get that from Alabama. Everybody's not going to get that from Ohio State. That's the thing. They just don't have, you know, their recruiting is a little different because they got all the infrastructure, you name it. They got facilities. They got everything that a lot of the historical black institutions don't have. And, you know, if we could turn back the hands of time, you know, the Alabama, the LSU, Ole Miss, Mississippi State, Georgia, Florida, they'd be at Florida A&M, Grambling, Jackson State, Alcorn, Southern University. That's where they would have been. And it's unfortunate it's not like that anymore. And it won't change. Let's be honest. It won't change, but the black college will always find two or three guys that are going to stand up and have an opportunity to go to the National Football League and do well.
The way I look at it, Doug, is it's a numbers thing that the talent is there. It's just not there in the overwhelming numbers that it used to be. Like
no, I'm not saying the quality of the black football is not there. Black college football is not there because it is. North Carolina A&T has done a tremendous job over the years. I mean, they beat two or three Division I schools who have to beat other teams. So they've got quality players. But as far as the number of guys that's going to play in the National Football League and get drafted, it's not there. I wish it was. You know, and I sit there and, you know, I watch these guys, and I would love to say, hey, we're going to get us four or five guys from historical black college on this football team. But it don't work that way because in my job and all the other guys across the country job, you would like to find that diamond in the rough. You like to find a guy that nobody thinks they can play. But you also got to be cognizant of the fact that you got to bring players in who could play because if you don't, your job won't be long. That's what it's all about.
Well, what is it that you look for when you are evaluating guys?
From the HBCU?
No, overall, just overall.
Oh, you're looking at, you know, it's an individual thing. See, a lot of people think it's a team thing. You know, I learned this in college. I mean, saying in college that, you know, you can't go by a team winning a championship that every player on that team can play at the next level because that's not true. You know, and a lot of parents get caught up with, you know, when he was on the state champion team, he was. But as a coach, you look at, you know, and I've been around it for a while. You're an athlete, you know talent. You know a guy who got some talent. You fix your mind as to how they fit in with what you want to do. Because what you do, you kind of look at your team and look at the guy that you're watching and kind of find out the position that he plays and think about the position that you have on your team and how would he fit in that, like, let's say for a cornerback. And you say, you know, think about the quarterback that you have, and you look at this guy and say, how can he help us as a corner? Would it be a number two? Would it be a number one? Would it be a number three, five? Where would you think he fit? Who is he better than? Because the National Football League, believe it or not, there's 53 guys that's on an active roster. And the bottom line is you always looking to replace the last five guys. Because if you can upgrade the last five guys on your football team, you're gonna have a better football team. And if one is better than guys further up, you don't even have a better football team. But you really try to make sure you can find five guys better than the last five on your team.
Did you have a mentor at all in terms of going into the front office, somebody you looked at and said, you know, I can learn a lot from this guy? Was it just a collective thing from working in Tampa and working in Jacksonville and these other stops in USFL and just pulling all that together?
Well, you know, for me, it was rather easy because I was one of the best mentors that I could have had, a guy by the name of James Harris. You know, James Harris has been in front of him a long time, and nobody talked more than Shaq and I about players. And, you know, we follow players. And especially at Black College, you know, I'm always, every week of the season, I got stats of every Black college in the country. And I'm only saying that because I'm a product of Black college. So yeah, I'm gonna do as much justice as I could if I could. But then my job is to follow players all over the country too. But talking to Shaq all the time, we don't talk about the Black college. We talk about all colleges and all players. Like I just, you know, went to All Star games the last 2 weeks. I'm down to East West for 4 days, down to Mobile for 4 days, and you know we start meeting. The scouts actually come in on Saturday, and we start meeting Sunday. I won't be back this Sunday, but Monday, for 2 weeks, we're sitting there and going with all these players across the country.
Well, you know, let's go back to your playing career in your USFL days. What was that like?
The USFL was, you know, I didn't play football. I missed a whole year of football, to be honest with you. When I left Tampa, I was there from 78 to 82, and, you know, the contract situation was unstable, so I didn't play at all in 83. And at that time, didn't really matter because coaching was on my mind. I was ready to go and coach. And the league had started already, the USFL, but that was a team starting up in Oklahoma, and the owners from the Oklahoma Outlaws called me. And, you know, we talked. They looked at me as part of their family, not just a football player. And to this day, I talk to the Tankers all the time. And his son, who ran the team, the first thing he tell me, he said, "My mom still got your picture hanging up in the house." You know, that's a good feeling that you want to be part of something. And I can honestly say the USFL produced a lot of great players. Now, the quantity wasn't there, but there was a lot of quality in there. You know, Reggie White. I played against Reggie White in my last USFL game in Memphis. You know, and you think about all the guys who went to the Pro Bowl, went to the Hall of Fame that played in the USFL. When I got to Washington, Ricky Sandler, Gary Clark, we had a Kevin Bryant. We had about seven guys on that Super Bowl team that had played in the USFL, which lets you know there was a lot of talent within the USFL. It just wasn't an abundance of talent.
Yeah, I'm thinking Jim Kelly came out of there, and Reggie White,
Steve Young played in the USFL.
Well, do you feel like if it had stayed a spring league, it could have survived?
That wasn't what it's about, you know. I think it could have survived where it was. I think we all know who brought it down. And I'm not going to call a name. He got enough problems that it is. You know.
Okay.
If we had kept it within reason, where we wasn't trying to, take over another league or compete or what have you, just keep it where it was. But I think what happened, it became so competitive and so much money was being spent on players for one or two players that they forgot about it was a whole league. And they were looking for a little bit of quality and not a whole lot of quantity. So if you only got a little bit of quality to go with the quantity that you got, it ain't going to work. And I think that's what happened.
Well, you were talking about the athletes who came out of the USFL and went into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And that leads me to one of your projects, the Black College Hall of Fame. I know you and Shaq organized that, founded that, and that's coming up next month. Talk about that a little bit and how and why and where it is now, where it stands now.
Well, Rasko, first of all, let me say, you know, we appreciate, you know, your contribution, what you do with us and what you've done. You know, nobody knows Black College as much as you because you've been involved in a long time. But Shaq and I used to talk all the time about, man, what if there's a Hall of Fame for all these great Black football players that nobody knows about? You know, you don't know about some, but we always talk about that. And for probably 5 or 6 years, Shaq and I, we formed our own foundation. You know, we had a golf tournament in Shreveport, and we started it with Hurricane Katrina. We raised $10,000 right off the bat, and we made sure that, you know, we gave a lot of kids, 1,000 kids or so, $100 a piece for Christmas, and they can only get toys or clothes. We made sure we worked with Walmart, and we weren't putting a certificate in a mom or dad hand that they can get whatever they want. That they had to go specifically to the kids. And we started doing that, had the golf tournament in Shreveport. But Shaq and I kept on meeting. And I flew out to Hawaii to June Jones golf tournament. And came back, Kevin Kaplan, who's the executive director of the foundation. We met in L.A., me, Shaq, and Kevin. And we were sitting there, we were having breakfast. And Shaq and I mentioned to him about the Black College Football Hall of Fame. He didn't get it. He didn't get it at first because he wasn't versed. He didn't understand. He didn't know about Black College. And rightfully so. You know, I wasn't going to charge him, but he should have known. And he slept on it. Next morning, he come out and say, I got it. And 10 years ago this year, we started the Black College Football Hall of Fame. And, you know, when you look back on it, man, it wasn't about just Shaq and I, because when you think about the guys that have been inducted, it's about everybody who contributed, coaches and everybody who contributed to Black College football, and guys that had not been recognized, get an opportunity to get recognized. And we're blessed because the NFL Hall of Fame, Dave Baker, who's the executive director of the NFL Hall of Fame, along with Joe Hargan and a couple more guys, met with me and Shaq, and they're the one that came to us and talked about preserving the history of Black college football. And they feel like the only way that you can preserve the history of Black college football is to put it in a safe haven. And they wanted us to be a part of Canton, Ohio, with the NFL Hall of Fame. And, you know, that was one of the most humbling experiences in the world for them to come and ask us to be a part, because now we do know that as long as Canton going to be over, which we think going to be over for a while, that Black college football will be alive. So that's where we are today, and, you know, we're looking forward to this 10-year event, induction, man, and we just got to blow it out the water. And again, I just want to say thanks to you, Rasko.
Well, you know, I've seen this thing, you know, from the start, and each year, you know, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and, you know, and just when you think that it's, you know, it's hard to imagine it getting any bigger, it does get bigger, and that's really, you know, a tribute to, you know, the vision that you and Shaq, you know, Shaq had. And you know, I'm sure Coach Rob would be proud of you guys for what you do. And, you know, to be honest, you know, you two guys, you know, you inspire me to try to do some things, you know, with various organizations that I'm involved in.
Right.
I think that this is something that all, you know, football fans, you know, should get behind, especially, you know, Black college alumni, because
right,
it's about more than
right
honoring the athletes. I mean, you know, you guys give scholarships to the schools,
right? Well, you know,
that's big.
No, you're absolutely right. But it's not only just historical, but it's a history. You know, Arthur Blank of the Atlanta Falcons, you know, and John P.R., a priority to payment. Those are guys that really helped us get it off. And I never forget Mr. Blank sitting there watching tape of players from historical black college that he didn't even know went to black college. And the first event, he sat there, and I went over and I told him, I said, Mr. Blank, I said, thanks, appreciate your support, thanks for coming. And he looked at me and said, this is too short. I was just getting to enjoy it because he saw the highlights of guys that he's heard of that he didn't know went to black college. And I think that's the history of this whole thing. There's a whole lot of other folks out there that don't know a lot of guys went to historical black college. But you're right in another aspect, Rasko. We, as a people, black folks who go to historical black college, we got to support, man, because the only way we're going to stay alive, we got to support each other. And I think that's the bottom line.
Right, right. No, my hat's off to you and Shaq for, you know, what you've done to get this thing rolling. And it's only going to keep getting bigger. I'm positive of that. I really am.
I'm looking forward to it, I promise
you. Yeah. Well, going back to your career, I know you said that your brother, you know, how much you looked up to him. But were there other quarterbacks that, you know, you looked up to, say, an Eldridge Dickey at Tennessee State or, you know, a Shaq, you know, at Grambling, guys like that? And how did they influence you?
Well, let me say this. When I was in high school, you know, number one, I think if you saw the Football Life, you understand that we didn't have a chance to watch many games on TV. When I think about that, but as a player, football was my first love. My brother made me play football. You know, baseball, I thought if I had a chance to go professional, I thought it was going to be in baseball. I knew I wasn't going to be tall enough to be the basketball player I wanted to be, but I was a big Pistol Pete fan. But I never forget Joe, Jefferson Street Joe, came down to Southern University to play. And I went to the game. I wanted to see Jefferson Street. And I was standing on the fence when he came out the dressing room. And, you know, I was a little scrawny, you know, 12th grade. I was skinny, a little scrawny kid. And Jefferson Street came out, and I said to myself, boy, he's skinny. I can play this game. You know, and just to watch him warm up, man, was intriguing. You know, so Jefferson Street, that's where it started. I got a chance to see him. Then I was a redshirt freshman at Grambling. This is God's truth. You know, my favorite guy became a guy at Mississippi Valley by the name of Carnell Pay Dirt Dickerson.
Yeah.
I sat in the press box, man, and watched Pay Dirt in 1973. You know, we were lucky enough to get out of there and with a win because Pay Dirt cut us up. Pay Dirt was throwing that thing, man. The people don't know, Carnell Dickerson was a bad dude.
Yeah,
and
he preceded you at Tampa Bay.
Yeah. Oh, I believe me. I know. We talked about it. But my thing is, I watched him. I knew Shaq. You know, because when I was in Grambling 73, I knew Shaq. And then, you know, with Shaq being able to come back and doing my career and be able to talk to Shaq, you know, it made it that much more that it became about Shaq to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Coach Rob always told us, hell, it's blocking and it's tackling. If they play football in the National Football League and you play here at Grambling, hell, you can play that because we do the same thing. You know, and that's how he instilled it in us. But with Shaq coming back every year, I never forget, you know, my senior year, you know, I used to back out from under the center, and he the one who told me, said, no, you got to turn out and square your shoulder. You know, you got to make step, you got to make a step. You know, Shaq the one that kind of got techniques and stuff down for me. And, you know, my senior year, I had a pretty decent senior year. you know, finish fourth in the Heisman, and Shaggy and I stayed in contact from that day on.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the things that, you know, impressed me about Grambling athletes, you know, going all the way back to Tank Younger, how they would, once they went off to the NFL, they would come back in the spring.
Always. And Coach Rob, during spring practice, Coach Rob would stop practice. No matter if one of them showed up, he stopped practice, called everybody around, and let them talk. Hell, you got to talk, Cap. No, Coach, I'm not here. You can't come here and not talk. Was that Willie Brown, Willie Davis, Buck Buchanan, James Harris, Charlie Journey? No matter who it was, you had to talk. And they came back. You know, it was a lot of incentive for us because we got a chance to see them all. Tank Younger, man, yeah, he comes through with that heavy voice and call everybody Judge, you know. Hell, Judge, you got to do this, Judge. You know, and that was inspiring. So, yeah, Coach Rob knew how to do it.
Yep, he was quite a guy. And you mentioned Tank Younger. He's kind of, I think, for my money, you know, he's overlooked. You know, very overlooked in that whole equation of, you know, not only black college athletes, but just
football, period.
Football, period.
Yeah, Tank Younger should be in Canton, Ohio. He should have an address up there. Canton, Ohio, no doubt about it.
Right, right. I remember talking to him and how he talked about how, you know, Coach Rob, you know, motivated him and told him that, you know, he had no choice but to make it, because if he didn't make it, then they could say, well, we took your best and he didn't make it. So who knows when any other HBCU athlete would have an opportunity. So he said that really, really motivated him. And he, you know, he went on to have an outstanding career with the Rams, then, you know, moved into front office and the Rams and the Chargers and did an outstanding job there as well. So he was really a pioneer on two fronts that, you know, people don't realize. And I think he should be recognized and honored for that.
Well, I agree. I think it's unfortunate he had not been so far, but he definitely deserved it, that's for sure.
Right. Well, Doug, I know you have to get out of here tomorrow and get down to Atlanta. We certainly appreciate you taking some time and sharing your insight and experiences with us. And, you know, good luck with you and the Skins and, you know, the draft coming up and your evaluations. And you take care, and we certainly appreciate you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Doug.
All right.
That was solid. That was some solid football right there.
Yeah, Doug is he's a solid guy. He's really, 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 really solid. And they don't come much better than him. It's just outstanding the work that he does. I mean, and he is all about, you know, black colleges. He certainly is, and that's great. It's really great. And I was serious when I talked about how he and Shaq, you know, an inspiration to me, because, you know, the things that they do, it's just, you know, it's just refreshing, because in so many instances you see not only black athletes, but just blacks in general, who, when they reach a certain status, you know, they forget, or don't, maybe not even forget, they just turn their back on where they came from. They just, you know, don't look back to where they came from. But not only do they look back, they go back and they give back, and that's the way that it should be.
Well, I appreciate the honest assessment he had of HBCUs. I mean, yeah, if anybody's gonna give a HBCU player a fair shot, it's gonna be Doug. But it's like you said, they have a lot more options and a lot more ways to go as opposed to an HBCU these days as it was back when he was playing.
Right.
But to keep keeping along in the HBCU theme, the SWAC lost a very important person over the weekend in their first full-time commissioner with Dr. Frank's passing. That was a huge blow. He was somebody that was really instrumental in the conference and shaping it up and making it what it is, making it what it is today. So Dr. James Frank, he passed, and he just has a great legacy there. I think he was the first African-American president of the NCAA. He's had a lot of significant accomplishments, but I know that I've dealt with him on several occasions, and he was a very straightforward guy. He was pretty guarded with the media, but he wouldn't lie to you. He just wouldn't tell you a lot.
Yeah. He and I, you know, we clashed a time or two over some things. But you know, you have to give him his due. You know, he was the first full time SWAC's first full time commissioner, and you know, he did some things that you know went beyond beyond SWAC. You know, he was instrumental in starting the creating the Freedom Bowl All-Star Game with Ken Free, who was the commissioner of the MEAC at the time, and that provided you know an opportunity for NFL scouts to come in and look at HBCU athletes, you know, all in one setting, whereas they might not have gotten that opportunity to be seen. And he also was involved in creating the Heritage Bowl, which I guess is the forerunner of the Celebration Bowl. It was a championship game between SWAC and MEAC, and that was really a first class event. It was so he was quite a man, and we grew to have a mutual respect for each other over the years, and my condolences to his family.
Yeah, absolutely. I know Trent was a classmate of mine. His son Trent Frank over in Morehouse, and and that's that was an end with Dr. Frank when I first started covering the beat, but that end ended really quickly when we started talking about business. So that didn't tear too much weight after that. But he was strictly business, and he was all about trying to make the SWAC as best as strong as he possibly could, and creating relationships and partnerships and alliances that would help the conference grow. So hats off to a job well done by Dr. Frank. Another piece of HBCU football news is that the Falcons have had changes over in the coaching ranks on their coaching staff after the season that Atlanta had. And one of the guys leaving, so not because he was fired, it's because he got another gig. And that would be the defensive back coach for the Falcons, Charles Jackson, who is now going to become the head football coach of Kentucky State. So that's going to bring a little bit of cachet to the Thoroughbreds over there in Lexington. So wishing Coach Jackson the best.
Well, it might bring some cachet, but he might want to think about bringing some of the Falcons players with him, because they had a tough season. They had a tough season.
Yeah.
I think they were 1-10 maybe?
Yes. I think that's exactly what it was. So it's like he doesn't have a hard act to follow, but nonetheless, hopefully he'll be able to bring some of that NFL and his job. I know he worked at the Air Force Academy as well, and he's been a really well thought of guy on the Atlanta staff, and they were sorry to see him go, but this is a great opportunity for him. And also, I was looking at where these HBCU powerhouses are considering some matchups coming up here in the future here with the MEAC and the SWAC. Southern AD has told boosters that he'd be interested in the game with North Carolina A&T in the near future. And Grambling and FAM could be headed for a post-2019 meeting as well. And those are the kind of games that really would gin up a lot of interest across the nation with HBCUs as opposed to these regional things. But you got some really powerhouse names there in those four schools.
Well, those schools, there are certain schools that I feel like, you know, should be playing each other on a regular basis, you know, the Tennessee States, the Jackson States, the Grambling, the Southerns, the A&Ts, the Florida A&Ms, you know, schools like that. They should just play each other because they are the schools with the, you know, with the name recognition and that have the strong alumni bases and the strong followings that, you know, that garner interest and that would do a world of good in promoting black college football. And frankly, that's what the game is missing. One of the things that the game is missing, that, you know, the marketing and promotion, and people don't really know. Don't know the players, who the players are, you know.
True.
Need to find a way to get the names out there. You know, as good as Darius Leonard was this past season in the NFL, he was just that good at South Carolina State, but who knew? Other than, South Carolina State and around the MEAC, you know, Tariq Cohen, you know, he had some name recognition when he was at A&T, but, you know, it wasn't, you know, as universal as it probably should have been. So this is just a better job of marketing needs to be done and promoting, and it starts, you know, by playing some of these, you know, kind of marquee matchup games.
And I think to an extent, you know, the first 2-3 months of the season, there are 400 classics among HBCUs, and, you know, that's none of them really stir the imagination for anybody. And I think these marquee, they should really just pare these things back to these marquee games take the name classic off of these things.
Well, you know, I say that a lot of these classics are classic in name only, and to me, classic falls into one of a few categories. It's a classic matchup in terms of the teams that I mentioned earlier playing each other, or it's a classic rivalry, you know, like the Tuskegee Morehouse. That's a classic rivalry. Been playing for approaching, 80 years they've played each other.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. But it makes no sense to take Savannah State.
A home game and stick it
in Chicago. In Chicago and, you know, call it
right.
A classic. No, no. That doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense at all. And really it's a drag on the sport, really, to do that. But who asked me?
Well, nobody asked any of the people who we could affect change here. One more thing before we go. A story came out this week that the Clemson did visit the White House, and where they were served fast food on silver platters with a note. They're just sitting out there getting cold because there were no burners to keep the food warm. But nonetheless, most of the black players for Clemson did not go. And to Clemson's credit, they didn't make the guys go, but it was the African-American players that did go were guys who didn't get much playing time, and they really were looking out for the first and second-year players who didn't play a lot. But it's the idea that the other folks felt any compulsion to go there, and you have to think that these guys are making those decisions on their own.
Right. And I also noticed where Mookie Betts said he's opting out of the Red Sox visit to the White House.
Right. It's not as special as it used to be, but I know something we're looking at is going to be special this weekend, and that is the Super Bowl. We didn't talk a whole lot about it, but you know who I got. I got the Rams by two touchdowns over the Pats on Sunday, and that's going to happen. And the MVP of this game is going to be Aaron Donald, a defensive player. And that's how it's gonna roll. That's how it's gonna
work. Not your boy Gurley, the Georgia Dog.
No, I'm not gonna do that. See, no, No, it's going to be defensive thing because you put the heat on Brady, who's only been hit three times this entire postseason. Put some heat on him, and it's going to be over. So what's your prediction there?
It pains me to say it. It really does. But I just see the Patriots pulling it out. And I think that they will find a way to slow the game down, play keep away, keep the ball away from the Rams' offense. And I think and I'm kind of pulling for Brian Flores, even though I don't know him, but he's the play caller for the
Patriots.
Right,
he's on his way, huh?
Who's in line to get the Miami Dolphins job?
Right.
He's a black guy, and so we need some more coaches in the black, some black coaches in the coaching ranks in the NFL. So I would like to see him, you know, add another page to his resume and ride off into the sunset in Miami and South Beach, you know, with a Super Bowl ring to his credit. But that aside, my gut just tells me that New England will win. Probably it'll be some funny business, but they will win.
We will see. And we will see y'all next time as well. We thank our guest, Doug Williams, who is just outstanding. He's an outstanding stand-up person. And we just hope to see you guys around next week. Well, Roscoe, we give these guys a chance to
continue to express yourself.
See you next time.
And now, on the African American Athlete Sports Network, it's Express Yourself with host T. Ramone and Sco. It's an hour packed with guests, opinions, sports news of the day, and off-the-field issues that impact play on it. And you, the listeners, will have an opportunity.